Hello and welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money, and helps you ultimately understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas, and today's episode joined by Alex. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Jonas.
And what we will do today is we discuss the topic of a Bitcoin reserve. So we have done a few episodes on this topic before, so earlier this year. So there was one episode which was rather bullish, which has been done with Frank Schaeffler from the German Liberal Party. And then we had one episode that was rather bearish, which we did with Jürgen Schaaf from the European Central Bank. And we, of course, got also asked from our community, because we were pretty neutral in these discussions, let's say. We didn't put our opinion into that. But what do you think about it? You know, is it now a good idea to build up a Bitcoin reserve or not? And this is exactly what we want to discuss in today's episode. And I think, Alex, this topic has more momentum than ever, if you will, if you look at the US, right?
Yeah, definitely. Very, very timely topic, of course. Trump has put out or signed this executive order in early March, where he wants or has established a Bitcoin reserve in the United States, emphasizing again that he wants to make the US the crypto capital of the world. What he was putting up there was basically a reserve that consists of Bitcoins that have been confiscated in criminal or civil law cases, which is currently around 200,000 Bitcoins in the US. The US will keep all those Bitcoins that have moved over into the possession of US government, which is, by the way, out of these 200,000 Bitcoins, that only applies to 88,000, because the rest has to be given back to its original users. But nevertheless, that's the approach of the US now. Any Bitcoins that have been confiscated and remain in the possession of the US government will be kept. They will not be sold, contrary to Germany, as many of you know, right? Saxony has sold its Bitcoin holdings, or had to sold its Bitcoin holdings. So different strategy in the US. What the US is not going to do, that's maybe also important, is it's not going to use taxpayer money for purchasing Bitcoins. Instead, Trump in this executive orders said, let's look for other ways to acquire Bitcoin. So they look at things like revaluing the gold reserves in the US and using that money in order to acquire Bitcoin, issuing Bitcoin bonds, using the savings of this Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency from Elon Musk. So these are the discussions that are ongoing. My impression is, Jonas, but also interested in your opinion, that these discussions are relatively silent. It has been like for 1 or 2 weeks. There were, like, of course, it created a lot of buzz. But since then, I think the US has other problems. But nevertheless, I expect this topic to come up again going forward.
Definitely. So I think currently there is a different focus in the US and on US topics, primarily about the tariffs and everything. But what I consider very interesting is that, you know, this would be 200,000 Bitcoin, so which is, of course, still a pretty high amount if we compare this to the 21 million. But this also means that for now, Alex, if I understood you correctly, the US is not buying new Bitcoin. It's only keeping these Bitcoins, but is evaluating some kind of, let's say, tax neutral options, you know, where the citizen has not to pay to potentially also acquire Bitcoins in the future, right?
Yeah, and pretty fancy options. So maybe let's spend a minute on this option to revalue the gold holdings. As you know, I mean, the US is one of the major gold holders globally. And interestingly, this gold is currently valued at, or I would have to lie, but it's around 42, 47 US dollars in the books of the US Treasury, while the gold price is actually, I mean, I'm not sure where it is, but somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 US dollars at the moment. So if the US decided to say, let's mark to market this price, they would have billions of additional capital freed up. Actually, there was one proposal in the House, I believe one draft, that was called the Bitcoin Act, that proposed exactly that. Let's revalue our gold reserve and then use that freed up capital in order to acquire additional Bitcoins.
I really like the names from all these laws proposed, like the Bitcoin Act and the Genius Act, you know, in the stablecoin context, the Stable Act. So it's definitely more sexy than the stuff that we use here in Germany or in Europe. You know, if we think about that. But yeah, I think that's, Alex, just like, I think very interesting, fascinating for me, because that would just be like, let's say, an accounting adjustment that would lead to billions, trillions, I don't know, in additional budget. Like, kind of insane that this could be, you know, like such an easy way, but I know it's not that easy, right? But it would, you know, wouldn't involve like a lot of other real stuff besides the accounting adjustments, I would guess.
And of course, it would be most likely highly inflationary, right? Because what you effectively do is you acquire an asset for billions, hundreds of billions. And of course, that means new liquidity in the market that has to go somewhere. So it's very likely going to would pump up asset prices and most likely also lead to real economic inflation.
I'm not sure if Trump has really understood all these economic implications from the stuff that he is doing, but let's see.
We should definitely talk a bit about to what extent we believe he's just super smart and plays 3D chess here in announcing this Bitcoin reserve, or whether he only wants to kind of make his voters happy. Let's maybe try to put that conclusion to the end, what we believe is his strategy.
But I think what's really interesting and what Trump definitely was driving also in his election campaign and also now is he made like a Bitcoin reserve reality. So there is this executive order that this is here. And of course, other countries look into that and look at the US and say, oh, wow, they are doing this. We should consider something similar, which is like very, very often the case in such things globally. So he definitely, I would say, started a movement. I'm not too sure if my prediction on I made on buildup of Bitcoin reserves by the end of the year is realistic in terms of, you know, newly bought Bitcoin, but at least it gives it another legitimation, let's say, after the ETFs that have been launched, which I think is really an effect that we, you know, which is currently, I think, heavily underestimated, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, and one thing I think we should put to the beginning of this discussion, because this is unfortunately very often confused, is what we actually mean by a Bitcoin reserve, right? Because there are different forms of a reserve. Jonas, maybe you want to walk us through the different kind of types of reserve that we might have to distinguish in our discussion today.
Definitely, because I have the feeling today people really, when you talk about Bitcoin reserve or crypto reserve, they really don't mean the same thing. So what we always tried with this podcast is to bring structure to all this debate. So this is also what we want to do today. But also, of course, want to reference that these models we are now, you know, defining or putting here into perspective again is also something that Jürgen Scharf mentioned in our episode of the Bitcoin Reserve podcast with him. So just as a disclaimer. So we think there are generally three different types of reserves. There is one which is typically really a strategic reserves, and this can have two different purposes. So you can divide these strategic reserves into two, if you will. One, it has basically the goal to secure the supply of, for example, relevant commodities in times of crisis. So an example here is oil or also medical supply. So this is for an extreme emergency where maybe, you know, there is not enough oil on the market, so you can go into your reserve. You can put oil on the market to, of course, mitigate very negative effects on the one hand side, and also kind of mitigate effects that have very, very high impact on the price in this context.
And these reserves exist, right? So for instance, I did some research. The US has a strategic petroleum reserve. It's about 714 million barrels. It's managed by the US Department of Energy. There's also a strategic national stockpile of public health and emergency items. There are other strategic reserves like a helium reserve, an emergency food reserve. So these things exist and are managed by various different government-led agencies.
So this is about emergencies, basically, and I think it's very important what you just said, Alex. This is managed by government-related entities. So it's not the central bank, but it's the government that is doing or holding such strategic reserves, if you will. And the second option, also still under the strategic reserve, is more reserves that foster monetary and financial stability and also increase the confidence in the home currency. So we know that in currencies, a lot is about trust. So if trust in central banks and in a currency go down, typically this often leads to inflation or even higher inflation if there is no trust at all. So this means there are some kind of instruments where you try to foster stability and also this trust. And here the typical example would, of course, be gold. So you put gold onto your balance sheet so that you could have them also in times of crisis, emergencies, and also to foster trust, because people know there is, you know, a very, let's say, heavy asset also in the balance sheet. And that's typically on the side of the central bank. That's, I think, also important to stress here.
Well, in Europe, that's true, right? In Europe, it's indeed part of the national central banks that hold these gold reserves. In the US, it's different. In the US, the gold reserve are actually managed by the Treasury, by the US Treasury. I think this goes back to the Gold Act. Don't quote me, I think 1934, where the central bank had to hand over its gold reserves in the US to the Treasury. I think the function the gold reserve plays in the US is the same in the sense of creating stability for the currency, etc. But it's not managed by the central bank, but by the US Treasury.
And of course, I think what's also important in this context is that typically the gold reserves that we have here in Germany and other countries still stem from times where we had the gold standard, where we have Bretton Woods, right? So they weren't established in the first place to establish trust, but they were just lying at different parts, different locations of the world, so that you could also potentially easily convert them into other, let's say, you know, foreign exchange, other currencies, if you will.
And funny enough, most of the European central banks are physically storing their central bank in New York, right? And I've read that the Germans are now thinking about bringing some of that gold back. I know the French have done so already many decades ago, and now the Germans are also considering bringing some of that gold back.
Yeah, and I remember that even 10 years ago, there was already this discussion in Germany. I think we did bring it back for some of them, but with all this turmoil in the US, I would say it's probably not a bad move to consider that, if you ask me.
Let's hope it's still there.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, like, you know, I'm laughing, but let's see what comes out of all of that. So this is like the strategic reserve, if you will. And then the second type of reserve is basically foreign exchange reserve. So basically what you do is if there is some kind of an undesired exchange rate movement or crisis on the foreign exchange market, the central bank can intervene to stabilize the prices to mitigate, again, negative effects that come from these, capital movements, exchange rate flow, etc. And that's, of course, typically also with the central bank. I'm not sure how this is, Alex, in the US. Is this also with the Fed or again with the Treasury?
No, that's with the Fed. But I'm not sure how actively the US Fed is really using FX reserves as a tool. I think that's something that more smaller central banks do. I mean, I'm sitting in Switzerland, right? The Swiss National Bank is very actively using FX reserves as a tool for monetary policy, now less so than in the past. What the Swiss National Bank did for many, many years was they defined a floor, an exchange rate floor to the euro of 120 Swiss francs. And they defended this by buying and selling FX on the global FX markets. So I would say rather a tool that's used by smaller central banks, but for these central banks, extremely important. And again, going back to the Swiss National Bank, they had to lift that floor at some point in time because their FX reserves wasn't a sustainable strategy, because these FX reserves, of course, are never unlimited and the pressure from the market was just too big. So also the size of these reserves and the way you use them can be a very important monetary policy tool.
Yes, and as you said, particularly for countries that are really having a fixed exchange rate or some kind of a corridor in which the currency has or should operate. I mean, this regard reminds me also what you mentioned with the crisis on the study program, right, where you talk a lot about currency crisis, you know, if the reserve, there are no reserves anymore, that even hedge funds or others are betted against some currencies, but probably a little bit too much for today. So this is the second type of reserve, so foreign exchange reserve. And the third reserve is basically something around a sovereign wealth fund. So it's basically a complete different animal, I would say, complete different goal. But what typically happens is that there are governments that invest money basically on the capital markets with the goal to basically increase the value, to make money. One example is Singapore or Norway or Saudi Arabia, where you have this really big funds where you invest in a lot of different assets with the goal to increase the value. That also, you know, you typically use this for pension systems, etc., that you have a good reward. That we don't have this in Germany to date, but we do have this in a lot of countries internationally.
And maybe in the future also in the US, right? That was also a topic that has been brought up, that the US might build up a sovereign wealth fund. And it's going to be interesting, because at the moment, the way Trump has announced this, let's say Bitcoin reserve, it would rather fit into what we have now called strategic reserve. So the first of those three models. But if the US really starts building up a sovereign wealth fund, it might also be that they move those Bitcoins, let's say, under the management of this sovereign wealth fund.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's the three different options. So you also see, that's why I personally really don't like the term strategic Bitcoin reserve, because this would basically mean that this is assigned to the one strategic reserve category and cannot fall into FX reserves or sovereign wealth funds. So this is why I just generally like to talk about a Bitcoin reserve and yeah, leave this strategic part out, because for me it's obviously more. But let's now go a little bit deeper into that and really look into some arguments in favor or against these three types of reserves. And when we go back into the podcast episode that we had with Jürgen Schaar from the ECB, and of course you find this in the show notes if you haven't listened to it, I really suggest you to listen to it. It was basically like an easy allocation, let's say, to the three reserves, because Jürgen basically argued that Bitcoin does not have the necessary properties to become a reserve asset for any of these three reserves. And he mentioned a lot of different aspects, which I would really like also, Alex, to see your perspective on, because it was a lot about, for example, that Bitcoin payments is rather like a marketing tool. So that he said, look, you do see that you can potentially pay with Bitcoin, but this is more done for marketing. It doesn't have a high value add, because you do have efficient payment networks today, right? So this is kind of, if you say, useless for this payment context. Would you agree with that, Alex?
Yeah. So I would agree. Maybe saying that it's completely useless for the payment use case is maybe a bit too strong, but that Bitcoin is not widely used as a means of payment, I think that's beyond doubt, right? Without any doubt. You can, of course, and this applies to all the, let's say, criticism that Jürgen Schaaf has brought up here, you can ask the question, is this a requirement in order for an asset to become part of a strategic reserve, right? And I'm not sure whether being used as a means of payment is a necessary requirement in order to become a strategic reserve asset, since gold, I mean, none of those assets that are currently part of a strategic reserves, except maybe for the FX reserves that we have mentioned. But I mean, oil, petroleum, medical supplies, and also assets in a sovereign wealth fund don't have this means of payment function. So I would say I agree, not really used as a means of payment, but I would add maybe not a necessary requirement in order to serve as a strategic reserve asset.
So what would be necessary then, Alex, I would say is, I mean, some kind of utility for these specific type of reserves. So, I mean, obviously it's not like a medication, right? So that you can have this for emergencies and then you have Bitcoin here, but that you say you have some kind of value propositions that basically allow Bitcoin to be a viable product under consideration, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe what we can do, and if you agree on us, interested in your opinion as well, but I would say what we can exclude is that second type of reserve model that we have presented, namely the FX reserves. So I would agree that Bitcoin cannot be part of something like an FX reserve, because it's not a currency. It doesn't serve as a means of payment. And actually here we are talking about US dollar, euros, Swiss franc reserves. And I would agree with Jürgen Schaaf that that's not a type of reserve that Bitcoin is made for.
Yeah. So I would also generally agree to that, because it has a different use case. But what I basically come up when I was talking to Jürgen in the podcast episode was also this perspective. We know that Bitcoin itself is some kind of a neutral technology, right? So you can use this for good things, you can use this for bad things, such just like the internet. But we currently do see that, of course, there is a lot of uncertainty coming from the US, right? And most countries today that have currency reserves, they do have the US dollar as a currency reserve. So maybe it's a way to have a Bitcoin here as a reserve, to say, I just want to make myself independent of the US, which is currently maybe doing some crazy stuff. And maybe in the long term, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, also, other central banks do have Bitcoin as a currency reserve, because they do see this, that they can swap this easily internationally, right? So maybe that's something more for the future, but I could see this in the long run, actually.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, I would put that argument more into the bucket of strategic reserve instead, in the sense of fostering monetary and financial stability. But of course, I agree what comes on top with Bitcoin that we do not have with gold is that it's easily transferable, right? Which of course brings it again a bit closer to the FX reserves, because you have let's now assume it's an asset that helps us foster monetary and financial stability. Gold sits somewhere in a vault, right? It cannot be moved. Now, if the US and Germany get into a huge fight, the US would have our gold, right? This cannot happen with Bitcoin. So of course this transferability is a big advantage.
Yeah. So I agree. It's kind of sitting somewhere in between, I guess, between the strategic gold type of reserve and an FX reserve, because Bitcoin you can really just easier transact, as you said. So yeah, it's probably somewhere in between.
I would still count it to the strategic reserves, because FX reserves are really used in order to affect exchange rates. And I'm not sure if I would not interpret the Bitcoin US dollar price or the Bitcoin euro price as an exchange rate. It's for me more like the price of an asset, namely Bitcoin. So I would still say Bitcoin is for me way closer to gold, and then rather falls into that strategic reserve instead of the FX reserve.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Well, something else that's of course important and should not happen with an asset that is put into a strategic reserve by a government is it should not be used for illicit activities heavily. And I think this is something where Jürgen Scharf is always very vocal about.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, what he basically says or argued is also that we know there are some data points out there about the illicit use of Bitcoin or crypto generally, right? So for example, the Chainalysis report that we know that we all appreciate in the space. But he was basically arguing that there is also the situation that often the numbers from the Chainalysis report, they are often corrected in size afterwards. So he basically mentioned that it's often adjusted by the factor of 1.5 to 2. So basically what he's saying that the real number is higher than the reported number. And he also said that basically some crimes that are, for example, taken place in fiat, let's say, and are then converted to crypto are not part of this methodology. So basically he points to an insufficient methodology to really properly measure the impact from Bitcoin on or from illicit activities that take place in Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, what he says is true. However, I find this a very weak argument, and I really don't like the way he and also Rick Binsile use this as an argument and the way they phrase this. I would say, I would even go as far to say this is from an academic point of view a little bit dishonest, because there is no sufficient, let's say, valid sources, or there's no sufficient data out there to make the statement that Bitcoin is heavily used for illicit activities. And I don't know if it is or if it is not, but I cannot go out there and claim that it is without having the required data or valid sources to back those kind of statements. And the, let's say, one of the best sources we have is indeed Chainalysis. I agree with Jürgen Scharf that Chainalysis, the number that is reported there is, if at all, the lower bound of what's going on. But it is also extremely low, right? It is way below 1%. I think it was like 0.2% or so. So even if I double or triple it, it's still a super low number. So I would rather have to say it needs to be like 20 or 30 times higher than that number that's reported by Chainalysis. But we just don't know. I would really like to see a bit more honesty in those discussions, and just be more open about that's the data we have. We don't know what's going on. There's of course anecdotal evidence that it is used for illicit activities, but we definitely can't make that statement that Bitcoin is for sure heavily used for illicit activities.
Yeah. And I mean, also here, you know, for the audience, for the listeners here, if you do know a really good objective source on this topic, maybe you think one is better than the Chainalysis one, and let us know. This was also something I asked Jürgen, but he also didn't have one at hand, I think. So if you do have better data, then let us know, because it's always important to look at data. And I agree, it's kind of the best data which is out there. But I mean, what I would always love to see is really a comparison of different types of money, different assets when it comes to illicit use. So if we today look at the reserves we had, and we talked about gold reserves, we talked about foreign exchange reserves, there is gold in there, there is the US dollar in there. And we know that there are a lot of illicit activities today, I would say the most globally, being done in US dollars, and also a non-negligible amount in gold, right? So what I would really like to see is also a comparison. So because I actually think, if the number is not crazily high, as you mentioned, Alex, then even if it's used for illicit activities, it's just the case. It doesn't, you know, it's not, I think, a feature, like an attribute that you're not allowed to have for a reserve, because in the end, you just cannot bring this down to zero. I think it just shouldn't be super, super high. And of course, it's up for debate what this means.
So where I agree with Jürgen Scharf is, I think he also made the argument that Bitcoin does not contribute, or is not comparable at least, to these medical supplies and the petroleum we have mentioned, right? You can't say we need a strategic reserve of Bitcoin because we have to use it in crisis times. We need Bitcoin in order to do anything with it. I would agree to that point. So I also think it's very, very hard to argue that we need to build up a strategic Bitcoin reserve that's, let's say, similar to a petroleum reserve or a reserve of medical supplies.
And it's definitely another utility that Bitcoin provides, I think. So, I mean, Jürgen is always saying that from his perspective, it doesn't provide any value or doesn't contribute to this production potential, if you will, from an economy, if you speak in economic terms. But I do disagree here when it comes to, this comparison to gold. The scarcity, we also talked in previous podcasts about the monetary premium for such assets, right? So I would say it's really not that it's like, I don't know, like a piece of paper, which is also scarce, which I put in my reserve, but doesn't have any value. So I think this, this is also not the full picture of Bitcoin.
But maybe we can like step by step kind of exclude or make clear where we agree with Jürgen and where we do not. And I believe we already arrived at the conclusion that probably FX reserve, that's a bit a long shot, right? To say Bitcoin as part of an FX reserve. And maybe Jonas, if you don't object, but please jump in if you see that differently. Maybe we can also agree that Bitcoin in the sense of a reserve of relevant commodities for times of crisis, like medical supplies and petroleum, we can probably also agree that that's not what Bitcoin reserve would be. So absolutely. I think the question is now really, can Bitcoin be a part of a reserve that's similar to gold? And here I would actually also agree with you. And I think this is where it's probably the most complex part of the discussion, this Bitcoin versus gold comparison. And is Bitcoin a bubble or not? Or does it contribute anything to the society or the economy? And I agree with you that Jürgen was very, let's say, clear there that he said like gold is different. I mean, gold has a long history. Gold is a physical asset. It has a very long track record, while Bitcoin is a purely speculative asset. It has no intrinsic value and so on and so forth. And I think that's maybe a discussion where we should spend a couple of minutes. Do we agree with Bitcoin being purely speculative and therefore also, of course, then it cannot and should not be part of a reserve that fosters monetary stability if it's a bubble, of course, right? Or is there maybe more to it than just speculation and bubble?
Yeah, I agree, because that's the most important question, I guess, around this, and also the most complex one. So I do see a lot of parallels to gold, actually. I mean, one obviously is just the scarcity. So for Bitcoin, we have the 21 million, as we know. I think 20 million are already in circulation. But again, this is like a necessary, not a sufficient condition, if you will, here. So of course, you also need other utility that Bitcoin is basically driving and creating. And I think there are definitely roles where Bitcoin is important. And I mean, what I always like to do, and this goes a little bit back to the payment discussion we had before, I think there is a use case for Bitcoin around payments if you look into developing emerging economies where Bitcoin actually is used today. Also, stablecoins are used today. And secondly, there is also the setup with Bitcoin that in times of extreme crisis where maybe payment system fails, etc., you have this as a backup system. And that's, again, it's not that it's used for payments and 50% market share today, but it's there and you could use it. And I think this is, for me, something that gives this really also a value, a different value than gold, where you can use this as jewelry, right? And it looks good. It's a different one. But I think that's also something that is often overlooked if you look at Bitcoin and compare this to gold.
I mean, we have talked about this topic here several times in the past. Like, is Bitcoin, like, what's the fair value of Bitcoin? Has it intrinsic value or not? I will definitely put a former episode that I did into the show notes. And I also wrote an FAZ article about it, which I will also put in the show notes. And what I did in this article was I tried to go back to kind of first principles and thought about where are prices coming from, right? And a price is usually an equilibrium of demand and supply. And I hope everyone can agree on that, right? Then I think we also can all agree on the fact that prices are only positive if demand exceeds supply. Because if an asset is not scarce, you mentioned that, Jonas, right? That's a very important condition you need. Needs to be scarce, meaning demand is greater than supply, and then you have a positive price. And of course, as you said, this scarcity condition is fulfilled in Bitcoin. Supply is limited to 21 million. Now, this is why actually the discussion whether Bitcoin has a fair value, positive or negative, can actually be limited to the discussion. What's the motivation for the demand? Because we know supply is limited, so we have to think about where's the demand coming from. And is the demand 100% purely speculation? Then I would agree Bitcoin is a bubble. It's a purely speculative asset. Or are there maybe other motivations for a positive demand for Bitcoin? I think without a doubt, a lot of the Bitcoin demand is driven by speculative motives, but I do also believe that there are other motives than speculation. There is a very small, let's say, part of the demand, and I want to emphasize it's today, it's very small, it might increase going forward, that comes really from, let's say, real economic use cases, namely using the Bitcoin blockchain as a decentralized, immutable digital ledger. It's, of course, that's something that you can use independently of whether you believe Bitcoin is gold or Bitcoin is money. There is a technology that you can use where you can store things on, and they will be stored there forever with a very high level of security. And I would say these are like real economic use cases. It's a bit comparable to the use of gold in the industry. There's like real economic use for it. And this is what you might want to call intrinsic value, right? There's a real economic use for it. However, I believe that a major part of the price and the value of Bitcoin is not coming from that real economic use cases, but more from Bitcoin's use as a, let's say, monetary asset. So deriving its value from being a store of value or a medium of exchange. And that's in my opinion, the part where we unfortunately have not enough research out there, because there is research out there on assets that have value that's above and beyond what you would call intrinsic value, or that can be derived from a cash flow, or that can be derived from a real economic use of an asset. And this is usually called a monetary premium. And this monetary premium is usually derived from trust and from network effects. And this is what, in my opinion, what people mean when they mean, well, I can move Bitcoin around globally. I can do it in real time, more or less. And there are historical examples of items that had none or close to none intrinsic value, but have been used for money and had actually real value for the people using them. For instance, these rye stones, right? You might have heard of big stones with a hole in it that have been used for hundreds of years as money. These were just stones. Some of them were even sitting on the ground of the ocean, but they still had value and served as money for hundreds of years. And the question is basically, can Bitcoin develop into something similar, basically an asset that can have a monetary premium and be used as money and profit from these network effects going forward?
Yeah, and I think that was really important, Alex, that you know opened this box and explained this a little bit more, because I think here we see again, so you mentioned trust, right? So often people say, yeah, you know, Bitcoin doesn't require trust, which I think generally is kind of true, but you still need to trust the technology, right? So you need to trust that the blockchain is still working. Every 10 minutes, a block is produced, all of that. And you do have the network effects. And I think this is something that is very, very often overlooked. And this is also what Jürgen actually mentioned in the podcast episode, where he basically said, okay, I mean, yes, Bitcoin is there, has a lot of volume in there today, but of course you can basically replace Bitcoin by a better technology. And that's, I think, something that is not so easily doable, because you do have these network effects after 15 years, you do have the ETF flows, you know, it has this attributes that are, you know, very worthwhile, very important as an asset. And I think that's also something where this difference is in the interpretation also from what Jürgen Schaaf and contrast for to us probably also comes from.
Of course, there can always be better technology. That being said, I'm not 100% sure what that would mean in the case of Bitcoin, because I fully agree that something like Ethereum can be improved, and they are working on that all the time, right? You basically said that, right? The kind of impact that better technology would have on Ethereum is way bigger than what it would have on Bitcoin, because these network effects is one thing, but also the history is so important, and the fact that it had been bootstrapped, right? It had never been centralized. It was from day one, it was decentralized and has been bootstrapped from there on. And in particular, I mean, Bitcoin, if it really, and of course, people have different opinions about what Bitcoin is. In my opinion, it could become something like digital gold. You don't need the, let's say, fanciest technology. You don't need to do 100,000 transactions per second if you try to be something like a digital scarce asset that mainly serves as a store of value. So I agree it's a risk vector that someone comes up with a way, way better technology and can improve Bitcoin, let's say, by 100x. But I'm way, way less concerned when this comes to Bitcoin than for these other, let's say, cryptocurrencies out there.
And I also actually liked the comparison to gold here, because also gold has a lot of attributes that justifies it as a store of value. But I would argue, depending on all your preferences, there is stuff that is way more beautiful than gold, that is more usable in the industry for specific things than gold. So I also here think, you know, there is always the time where you know, technology changes, but even in times today where we talk about getting everything digital and have, you know, artificial intelligence, gold is still around, right? So for this use cases, it's totally fine. Even if it's super slow, you cannot, you know, easily ship this globally. You know, it's painful that lots of features are really not good. But for the important ones, it is. Thus, it's accepted as a store of value. And thus, it is lying in reserves, right?
Yeah, I think we need a bit more, let's say, proper research from well-known academics in order to bring that discussion into, let's say, central bank circles. Because I also admit, I mean, we both of us talking about something we just call monetary premium is not going to convince a central banker changing his or her opinion. So let me just point out to a, let's say, whole strand of research that's going into this direction. It has never been applied to Bitcoin, in my opinion, but it, as far as I know, but I think it can be. And that's the literature around safe assets. There's literature around safe assets, around moneyness of certain assets, around, it's also sometimes called a convenience premium. So researchers like Arvind Krishnamurti from Stanford and Annette Wissing-Jürgensen from Berkeley, I believe, they have, for instance, shown that their assets have so-called non-pecuniary benefits, which means assets can have a value that goes above and beyond the cash flow value of those assets. And I think that's a nice literature that can be used and should now also be applied to Bitcoin. And I really hope if there are any, let's say, monetary theory researchers listening to this podcast, please take a look and take into account or consider if that's not an interesting topic for research, because I think that's what we need in order to bring that discussion into, let's say, these academic and central bank circles.
So where we're basically staying, Alex, is to say, okay, this strategic reserve similar to one with gold, so to foster monetary and financial stability and increase confidence, that's something we could see for Bitcoin, I guess. And we didn't talk a lot yet about the third option, which is basically the sovereign wealth fund. And this, I guess, maybe also goes into the direction, at least a little bit, what Frank Schaeffler said, who was way more positive, in this discussion. And one was basically saying that, I mean, we particularly talked about the central bank, to be honest, but I think this also applies to states, that it's always not a bad idea to put eggs in different baskets. So, and this is probably an argument for both again, right? So for this gold type comparison and for the sovereign wealth fund. But I guess that's an argument that I personally, like, because in these times you don't know. And this would also be another factor, I guess, for these two type of reserves.
Yeah. So I would also agree with that argument that diversification is always a sensible thing to do. However, where I would disagree is that I'm not sure whether this argument is strong enough to say Bitcoin should be something similar to a gold reserve. Because even though I have now argued a lot in favor of Bitcoin being actually a proper asset with a let's say, positive fair value, I would still say it's not where gold is today, right? Gold has served as a store of value for thousands of years. Bitcoin lacks that historical stability. So it's at least, let's say, very risky to say I'm already starting today building up a Bitcoin reserve in the sense of like a gold reserve, because Bitcoin is just still a very volatile asset. So to be frank, even though I agree with Frank Schaeffler's argument here, I would rather apply this argument to say maybe Bitcoin could be something that I allocate some of my sovereign wealth fund portfolio to, and not to sell it as a gold-like reserve, but more like as an investment for the future. And I take a little bit of risk here with a potential significant upside going forward.
And that's, I guess, really depends on the risk appetite and again, the institution that is behind that. So here in Europe, we mentioned this, that the gold reserve is typically managed by the national central banks. And then we also discussed that before, that the president from the Czech Central Bank was, for example, also or is currently also considering that. So that would exactly fall into this category. But I agree, Alex, that we need to be patient. Like Bitcoin is out there now for 17 years, gold is for thousands. So, and we are living in our bubble. We have to admit this as well. So it's risky, period. This is what you see every day when you look into a portfolio currently in these times, like period, right? I think there is no doubt. But the other one is really about this sovereign wealth fund, where you basically say, look, we have a portfolio, there is a lot of money in there. You know, sovereign wealth funds invests in stocks, in bonds, in whatever, in all kind of assets. And here the argument could be, and that's, for example, also what typically BlackRock says, who, of course, also wants to sell their ETFs. So, of course, we need to make this disclaimer, but who says in a lot of portfolios, up to 2% of Bitcoin can make a lot of sense and have like a positive impact, at least long-term, on the performance. And here we are in a different story, but also an interesting story.
And Frank Schaeffler made another very interesting point, which went into the direction of international competitiveness. And couldn't Bitcoin, like us, or meaning us in the sense of Europeans investing into Bitcoin, be a sign to the global community that we are very forward-looking, tech-based, tech-friendly location to make business in and kind of attract businesses around the world? I would make a related, not similar, but related argument, which might explain, and now I'm coming back to the 3D chess of Trump that I have mentioned before. So is he just super smart? And is there kind of a deeper reason why he has announced this Bitcoin reserve? Because there is indeed, in my opinion, an international competitiveness, or put differently, a geopolitical context to this question. Namely, what you could think about is that building up a strategic Bitcoin reserve now might be interpreted as a hedge against countries like Russia, China, and Iran also turning to Bitcoin in the future, right? It might happen that these countries, which as the whole world very much rely on US, let's say, influenced or even controlled payment systems, or the US dollar first and foremost as a reserve currency, but also the SWIFT payment system. The US has a lot of power over this payment system. Russia, China, Iran, and so on, they rely on these payment systems and these currencies. There is a certain chance that they decide to turn to Bitcoin. And I've already read that they are, you know, I'm not sure if you've seen that they are using Bitcoin already to, I think for oil trades or something like that.
At least what you read, yeah.
Yeah, they use Bitcoin as a settlement asset. So maybe it could be interpreted as Trump kind of seeing that danger and say, let me already, as one of the first ones, build up that Bitcoin reserve and be one of the, let's say, controllers of this Bitcoin currency on top of the US dollar as a currency as well, in order to prevent any other countries from taking over.
And I mean, there are a few aspects. So one is really to have so many Bitcoin, then of course, I mean, you probably, the US will never get like 50% to really control the network at 51, and I really hope they don't. But of course, the more, you know, you have also when it comes to mining activity potentially, right? That could be an interesting strategic chess dimension.
Already earning, let's say, I think the plan was 5 million Bitcoin, right? So earning a quarter of all Bitcoin reserves globally also gives you, of course, a certain control and power in that network.
And I mean, the other interesting aspect is here, of course, I mean, you often do see first mover advantages, but here it's a complete different level, I think, because we have, again, 21 million Bitcoins, 20 million are out there already. Imagine a country like maybe, you know, Russia, you know, Iran, whatever you mentioned, or being another country, it doesn't really matter, going in there with, I don't know, 100,000, 1 million Bitcoins they want to buy. The demand side would be so, like the demand would be so high for this supply, where it's not a lot currently lying around on exchanges, etc., which could really give like this, let's say, this God candle that the crypto pros are waiting for.
Well, they wouldn't buy it all at once, right? I mean, we have some empirical evidence, and that was also, maybe we can combine that with that argument of Jürgen Scharf, who said Bitcoin, the market is not liquid enough, so it can't be a reserve asset. The Bitcoin market is quite liquid. It of course cannot be compared to, let's say, major stocks like Apple and Microsoft or gold. Indeed, it's less liquid, but I would still, let's say, characterize it as highly liquid. And we have empirical, let's say, evidence on whether it's possible to buy and sell huge amounts of Bitcoin. For instance, when Saxony sold its, I think it was 200,000 Bitcoins they sold. I can't remember. And I talked to the guys who did it, right? It was a company in Germany called Tradias. They made it happen in a couple of weeks. So it didn't take like a year or so. It was, of course, also not possible to do it within a couple of days. But they did it in a relatively price-neutral way over a couple of weeks, maybe very few months. So if you decide as a country to acquire Bitcoin, let's say 1 million Bitcoin, and you give yourself 2 years or 3 years to build that reserve up, you could do it in a relatively price-neutral way. However, if you want to do it way faster, we might see that God candle.
Yeah. but still, Alex, isn't this like a very important and a very high difference between selling the Bitcoins and buying the Bitcoins? Because for selling, you know, the ETFs were buying, there was a very high demand. So it was, I mean, for me, it was I mean, wouldn't say logical, but it was way easier to get this in a neutral way. But now, I mean, I don't have current numbers on how much, you know, how much crypto you do have on exchange. And of course, I understand you can do this OTC, but of course you would need to give an incentive for selling the Bitcoins in this size in the first place. So what I'm really wondering is it really possible to do it in a neutral way? Because I'm not sure if really, let's say like 200,000 Bitcoins, people would like to sell this for the current price. They would like to get a premium, right? Which is a price increase. But yeah, it lacks empirical evidence for that.
No, it's a fair point. And of course, saying that buying or selling is price neutral, that's never true, because of course, there's always the counterfactual, what would have happened if I hadn't sold or bought? And of course, the price would be at a different place. But what's meant is, of course, that my single buy or selling order is not significantly moving the market price. And I think that's very much a timing question. I mean, consider now the last weeks, right, where the price went down from more than 100K to less than 80K. I think it would have been very easily doable to buy 200,000 Bitcoins over the last weeks without pushing the price up. Of course, if there is a bull market, that's a different story. I mean, there are still a lot of new Bitcoins entering the market every day through mining. They need to be bought by someone. And I think it's more the question of what's the market sentiment at the moment, whether it's easy to acquire Bitcoin or whether it just takes a lot of time to do it without pushing up the price too much.
And the question is also for me, where is this threshold where it really leads to a very highly increasing price? Because of course, what you're describing, Alex, at some point, this effect is not just not possible anymore because people want to get way more money to sell their Bitcoins, right? So if I imagine now a country that wants to buy 1 million now, you know, a premium would be necessary for that, right? Yeah. And of course, I mean, or let's say it just can be one country with 1 million, or it can be five countries with 200,000, right?
And that's also the big difference between whether countries see a Bitcoin as a strategic reserve similar to gold or a sovereign wealth fund investment, because countries will not care what the Bitcoin price is if they acquire it and it's motivated by being a strategic reserve. You're just not interested in what the price is. You just want those Bitcoins. While if you see it as part of a sovereign wealth fund, you of course have to be aware of kind of the return you're potentially making with this asset. And then this buying behavior would be totally different. I mean, anything I have seen from countries until now was more towards this strategic reserve and price insensitive buying. And I think that's also true for the US. I mean, they won't decide. I mean, it's basically defined, right? They're going to hold those Bitcoins that have been seized no matter what the price does. Let's see. I mean, if they add it to their sovereign wealth fund, their buying and selling, or mainly buying behavior, will probably be totally different.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at El Salvador, Bhutan, for example, who have very high reserves, if you also allocate this or measure this by the population, and that clearly goes into the direction of a strategic one. But interestingly, there are also some countries that are going into the sovereign wealth fund direction. So I think Abu Dhabi bought Bitcoin ETFs, I think it was $500 million or so. So still there is, you know, can be more, but we do see first movements here. And I agree, that's actually a great point, Alex, that there is a different financial expectation behind that. If you do this A for a strategic reasons and you're just your hodler, you know, of some kind, of course, you will sell it at some point, but you don't think about that. Or if you're doing this because your fund wants to see performance, because this is also what people, you know, can get out of when they retire or need, you know, need this money to build bridges and infrastructures. So the motivations are really different. And of course, again, also if this is the central bank or the state, right? So the strategic one, at least for Europe, would be the central bank. For the US, I understand it's different. I'm not sure how this is with other countries, but the sovereign wealth funds obviously sits with the governments or a government-related entity, if you will.
Correct. So maybe it's a good time to wrap it up and summarize and give our final kind of conclusions. We had now these three different Bitcoin reserve models. We already kind of excluded the FX reserve as something we believe Bitcoin could be part of. So, and we also excluded that, let's say, reserve, strategic reserve of relevant commodities like medical supplies and petroleum. So we are left now with those two types of reserves. One is similar to the gold reserve in order to foster monetary and financial stability. And the other one is that sovereign, part of a sovereign wealth fund. So Jonas, what would be your conclusion? Can Bitcoin be part of one of those two remaining reserve types or models?
So, I mean, can, definitely yes. So I think it has the features to be there, to do so. I think ultimately it really depends, of course, on the risk appetite. And we know that central banks typically are slow when it comes to, you know, using new assets that are just there around for 17 years. So I think that's something that we could see, but probably over decades or maybe even longer and not for years. So I think this strategic gold type reserve is more a long-term game. And of course, the other way, the sovereign wealth fund, I think that's for me quite logical, let's say. I mean, there are good reasons to put as an asset, as a store of value, to diversify and to put some Bitcoins like gold. I think gold also, for me personally, should be part, no investment advice, of course, but it's part of a good portfolio. It shouldn't just be stocks or just be bonds. So I think if it's, of course, in a fraction that you can sleep well at night, and this is for individuals, but also for a state, so I wouldn't, you know, put 50% into that. But of course, and this is also, Alex, like a strong situation or difficult situation, you need to have a sovereign wealth fund in the first place, right? We don't have this in Europe. We don't have this yet in the US. And Jürgen Scharf also very rightfully made this point, and I agree with him here. For a lot of countries that have sovereign wealth funds, money, I mean, wouldn't say doesn't really matter, but they need to spend the money anyway. So they can put a little bit, you know, small percentage into Bitcoin. It doesn't really harm them. But where we are currently in the Europe discussing about spendings for military and now also get a lot of tariffs, where is this money really coming from, right? And I think that's, of course, a question where you really need to watch out that this is not the taxpayer that is getting an overproportional amount of risks by getting, I don't know, 10% of a sovereign wealth funds into Bitcoin.
Yeah. No, I think we are pretty close here. I would definitely also agree that Bitcoin can be, of course, in small single percentage allocation of a sovereign wealth fund. Where I am a bit more, let's say, skeptical is that equivalent to a gold reserve, for the simple reason that I believe it's too early. And it's not the... Let's say it shouldn't be the goal of a central bank to take too much risk, in the sense of I'm going into an asset now, which is still very volatile, still, I would say, a risk on asset, very speculative, and invest big chunks in building up a reserve of that asset just in the hope that it's becoming something similar to gold in the future. I believe central banks, or in the US, the US Treasury, should just wait for a couple of more decades, most likely, whether Bitcoin is really becoming what it's currently seemed to becoming, namely something similar to digital gold. And then there is still enough time to invest into Bitcoin, because, as said, this strategic reserve, similar to a gold reserve, this is not about making money. It does not matter at all where the price of Bitcoin is, and it's not the goal to get in cheap now in order to make a profit going forward. It's more really to say, I want an asset that has a proven track record of being a safe store of value and can help me foster my monetary and financial stability. And if we are really honest to ourselves, empirically, Bitcoin is not playing that role yet. There are a lot of theoretical reasons and reasons that can be derived from how Bitcoin is designed that it might play this role going forward, but it's not there yet. And this is why I believe it's not a good idea for anyone, be it central banks or treasuries, to build up a Bitcoin reserve in the sense of I want to foster monetary stability. It might be a good idea to have a small allocation in a sovereign wealth fund. And if you really, let's say, don't care at all and geopolitics is the everything you think about, it might also make sense from that perspective here. But I would say this is also still a bit risky. And here also the US could probably afford buying only after Russia and China have started buying because they have more financial power. But that's the only reason where I would understand maybe that it might make sense from a geopolitical point of view to start acquiring Bitcoin right now.
And that was actually, I think, very important what you said in the end, Alex, because here I actually think we are 100% aligned. So that this really... Actually, as a central bank, you should wait longer to see if this is really a store of value, gold type of thing. We currently see that the correlation is rather with stocks, with tech stocks, and it's definitely not there yet. But if you are a central bank that puts a higher emphasis on these strategic considerations, so saying you're really scared about what's happening in, you know, BRICS countries and other countries, and you want to, you know, do something against that, if you have this perspective, I think then you could even before that, so not just in 20, 30, 50, 100 years potentially, but also before, acquire Bitcoin. But here we are again talking about very low demands, right? So I'm not saying that you should, Frank Scheffler, I think, suggested to have at some point the same amount as the gold reserves today to acquire. I mean, maybe that's something for the very, very long run. I'm not sure if I will still be alive by then. But I think that that still can, even in current times, be a reason why in the next year a central bank could do that. Again, depends on the risk appetite and how you interpret this currently interesting and dynamic world. But yeah, I mean, that's you know, with the central bank to figure out what's the best strategy.
So stepping back and taking kind of a view of the, let's say, last 5 to 10 years, I think it's still absolutely incredible that we are now talking about this topic at all and that kind of nation states are considering acquiring Bitcoin into their reserves. I mean, if you... of course, Bitcoin are talking about this for many, many years already. They have been laughed at for many years, and now it's kind of a reality, whether it makes sense or not, and whether it's the right timing or not. I think it's absolutely impressive how far we have gotten in that space.
Yeah, and I mean, probably bore the listener now because I've said this probably 10 times before, but even in the current times, if you look at how volatile the markets are and that there are still 100 billion in assets lying in Bitcoin ETFs, you know, that's also some kind of this data points, which if you zoom out, you just, you know, probably shake your head and say, okay, this is really crazy and so much different from Alex. I remember when we first, you know, chatted in 2017 or so, this was a complete different world back then. Great. So I would say, Alex, let's wrap this up. So we hope. Thanks, of course, for you, Alex, to be here with me and to get your perspective, insights into this topic. I think it's highly relevant and it's important to bring some structure into that. And of course, also for all the listeners, thanks for listening to our podcast, and would also be very curious to hear what you think about this discussion, because I'm sure it's a controversial one. So if you want to discuss with us, join our Telegram group where we have a lot of community members around and discuss a lot around these topics. So come join our community. And if you like what we discussed today, or also generally the podcast, of course, please feel free to refer us to your friends, your family, whoever is interested in digital assets, digital money around you. In your environments, we would appreciate this support. And of course, feel free to subscribe to all our channels and follow us on LinkedIn and co. In this sense, Alex, thanks so much and see you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.